a Japanese research group about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago, they actually painted their cows. The cows with zebra stripes. And turned out to be, they counted the frequency of fly bites. Turned out to be those painted versus without painted, they found that after the cows being painted with zebra stripes, biting rate was reduced by 50%.
I busted my cat scratching the couch yesterday. As soon as she caught my eye, she stopped scratching and started to stretch instead, acting as if she hadn't just been caught digging her claws into our brand new four-seater. The question is, did she know she was trying to deceive me? Or did it just look that way through my human eyes? Lee Sing Sun is the man with the answers. A professor of biology at Central Washington University and the author of The Liars of Nature and The Nature of Liars, Li Xing's work explores how and why animals deceive. On this episode of the podcast, we talk about why the Navy painted zebra stripes on their ships during World War II, why a duck would want to sit on a volleyball, and how cuckoos and warblers negotiate peace in an egg-switching arms race. If you enjoy the podcast, show your support by clicking on the link to our Patreon in the show notes. You could end up with a completely bullshit job title on the show. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Congratulations on the book. It was a really fun read. I laughed, which I think is the first time I've ever laughed while reading a science book. Well done.
Probably a little bit too academic.
Academic can be fun. I got the main thing I got the impression from reading the book is that you really love this topic and that you really get a lot of pleasure from exploring all the ways in which animals can be deceptive. Do you have a favorite? Is there one that you always start with that you always want to talk about when it comes to deception in the animal kingdom?
I actually do not have a favorite, but I mean everything from bacteria all the way to humans are fun. Some of the episodes, even during my research, some of the things I discovered, I mean, that was fascinating as well. So I actually often think back, what is really something that I had not paying attention until I was putting down. So yeah, and from I worked on a variety of animals, from the camouflage in frogs to the kind of cheating in monkeys.
One thing I particularly liked was when I heard about the book and when I read the New Yorker article about the book and went, oh, well, this is a book I have to read. And then once read the book, was like, well, this is someone we have to have on Scammapalooza. That when I first heard of the book, the first question that came into my mind was, hang on, how can you tell whether an animal is being deceptive? Because we have no idea what an animal is thinking. It might just be performing a certain behavior. How can they possibly know that it's deceptive? And you answer the question, I think, in the first paragraph that you really can't. There's no real way of knowing an animal's intent when it comes to this deception in amongst animals. So if we don't have that intent that we have with humans, that kind of intent to deceive, how do you then define deception when it comes to animals?
Yeah, that's the first challenge. So we have to follow the observable behavior instead of something that is, we try to figure out intent, which is virtually impossible for most animals. In some apes, like a chimpanzees or bonobos, it might be, you know, we can infer they are cheating. But still, in most animals, I think a behavior is enough, as long as they're supposed to tell the truth, but they don't. In the situation, they're showing they are benefiting from manipulating others, for example, or providing false information to others who are benefiting for themselves. And that is that should be considered as cheating.
So it's less about whether the animal intends to deceive or wants to deceive, because in some cases, when you mention bacteria, of course, there's no way they're going to have intent to deceive.
Exactly.
But it's rather, did this behavior or did this attribute of the animal cause another life form to be deceived. It's more about the deceived than it is about the actual thing doing the deception. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, it is, yeah.
So you mentioned primates and the possibility that you could perhaps try and figure out their intent, and you would do that just by inferring. How would you begin to figure out what an animal intends to do?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. The animal consciousness has been such a big deal in debates, both in philosophy and science. It's a bigger issue, but as more and more we understand them now, I agree with most of the primatologists, at least, or maybe some other animal biologists, that some animals are absolutely conscious about what they are doing. For example, apes, monkeys, and maybe even in dolphins and whales, their brains are large enough to have that kind of feeling. One of the Australian writer by the name of Godfrey Smith, you probably have heard, seen his book as well. It's What is Octopus Consciousness or something. And he argued that as well. And consciousness really is an evolutionary process instead of whether humans have it or animals don't. It's just a gradual transition. So in that case, and from the recent studies from behavior and cognition of these animals with large brains, and yeah, definitely they have a clear consciousness and intention as well.
So it's not we can't really put it into a binary of they either do or they don't, but rather there's gradations of what it actually means to have that intent. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. In one of my articles, I argued against the kind of traditional way of saying, oh, this is anthropomorphism. I mean, you use the human language, human description, human behavior to infer to animals. I think we should embrace anthropomorphism with some kind of discretion, but not reject it. I think that this is an old idea.
I must admit that reading the book, it was very difficult not to anthropomorphize the animals that you were talking about, partly because I'm a human, and that's a natural thing to do. And also, I'm someone who most of my exploration of deception is about human deception. So it's very, you know, it's natural for me to try and imprint my idea on there. But also, some of the blame has to be yours, because you call them con artists and swindlers and hustlers and throughout the book, and you do you certainly give them human characteristics as the book goes on, more as a, you know, not as a scientist but more as an author, because it is something very human to do is to put those human traits onto animals. Do animals take advantage of that? I mean, I don't know, for example, you know, dogs limping around or putting on certain facial expressions to indicate perhaps that, you know, they look sad by a human's definition of sadness when perhaps they're not.
Yeah, dogs do it a lot, as now cell phone videos are so much available. Yeah. You look at the TikTok, you look at all these short videos, you see these pets doing incredible things which we used not to think that's possible. But clearly, I think dogs is still a maybe, but the monkeys and apes definitely can. And they pretend to do these things. I once saw a chimpanzee and play with you. They use the fingers to signal you to come nearby, and then use the fist to hit your face through the glass. The glass separator, just try to play with you, but to fool you to come near, and they give you a scare.
Yeah, I also think there's a famous story. I was going to say that famous story of the gorilla who broke a sink in their enclosure and then tried to blame their toy cat.
One thing I would like to share with you based on my own observation. In the Tibetan macaque, there is one common behavior that most of these females are monopolized by these top ranking males. So the low ranking males were not dare to mate with females, so even approach them. So yeah. once they actually, they do sneak with these matings for low-ranking males. So what they would do is to mate with female, but if they are spotted, they pretend to divert the attention to the observers when we were observing them, and they were mating, and they got spotted by higher-ranking males. The female ranking males would approach them with aggression. And then the low-ranking males just broke off the mating and then yelled at us to divert the kind of attention to us, so as to make the high-ranking males to pay attention to us instead of paying attention to them. So that was fascinating. We often saw that.
And that complexity of deception, the way in which it's not simply just an animal deceiving, it's an animal deceiving and then having, you know, other animals or humans reacting. I think you referred to it as an arms race almost of deception. I think the cuckoo in the book was the one that really struck me as far more complicated than I had ever imagined when it comes to deception in animals. I knew that cuckoos would put their eggs into the nests of other birds, and those birds would be tricked into raising the young as their own. But the level of the way in which the other animals have to react to that, and then the cuckoo's reaction to that, just adds so much complexity to what is going on.
Yeah, it's arms race means you try to deceive others while at the same time you try to avoid being deceived. So yeah. That's kind of social manipulation, or one try to stay ahead of the other. But in this kind of situation, in the cuckoo, and the cuckoo tries to parasitize on the nest host, such as reed warblers, which is the most common bird in European Asia. But of course, that would incur the kind of cost, the fitness cost to the host. The host would fight back by having a better discrimination ability, for example. Better way of recognizing their own eggs versus others, so that they could selectively kick out or feed the chicks of their own while trying to avoid wasting their resource on cuckoos, or just simply throw the cuckoo eggs out. But this isn't also you run the risk of throw the babies with bathwater, right? As we often say. So when the parasitism rate is low, it's not much of a danger. It's a rare situation. So the reed warblers would not reject the cuckoo eggs or even something looks similar. But when the parasitic rate is high, they have to, because they would lose a great deal. So that is sort of like based on how much of their nests are parasitized. I think from Nick Davies' study at Oxford University, Nick Davies' study, they showed the 6% is the line that below that, the warblers will not reject all the eggs. Above that, they increasingly more likely to be selective, to be careful about potential cuckoo eggs. So it's arms race in every stage. The cuckoo wants to be masquerade themselves better, while the warbler tries to outsmart, outwit the cuckoo. So that is the kind of evolutionary process still going.
And so you have a situation where it's in the warbler's best interest to accept a small number of eggs, so as not to, I guess, incur the wrath of the cuckoo later on down the line. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. When the parasitic rate is very low, it's a rare event. I mean, you have more danger by throwing out the wrong eggs, for example. So they stop doing that when the parasitic rate is very low, 6%.
A lot of this comes down to the fact that birds, and particular warblers, I guess, are not very good at identifying eggs. And I thought that, because I would have assumed that cuckoos would only target species whose eggs were identical, because obviously a mother knows its children. And yet in the book, you're saying that you gave this extraordinary story of a goose that gave up sitting on its own eggs in order to sit on a volleyball because it was a bigger. It strikes me then that a lot of this behavior is, and perhaps all of it is largely instinctual. They know I need to sit on these eggs. I need to look after them. But it's not about the intent of the bird. The bird is just driven to perform this act because in the past, previous generations survived by performing this act. A lot of it is a lot of it just feels like blind instinct.
Yeah, I agree with you. That was based on one of the Nobel Prize winners by the name of Nico Tinbergen, who used to work at Oxford University. And he spent many years working on how these eggs could stimulate maternal behavior, especially in goose and some other species. So what he did was to see the limit of their cognitive ability. So he artificially create large eggs, the round shape, and with small eggs, it turned out to be the goose prefer large eggs. And from then, he gradually realized that, well, there was actually no limit for goose to pick large eggs. So that was the volleyball thing, and as ridiculous it can be. But the volleyball is round, the round object, as long as large enough, would stimulate the kind of maternal behavior in goose, in mama goose. So there's no limitation. But if we look at the nature, it never happens, right? Round objects suddenly occur at your doorstep, right? In front of a goose nest, that's not possible. So it would never fail for the goose to retreat a round object whenever they are nesting. So it's only artificial deciphering of the kind of cognitive ability of a goose. So that was the major contribution.
It reminds me of you often see pigeons like rock doves that are living in cities attempting to build nests, and they don't need nests because they tend to. There's not many trees and places to build them. So that sort of traditional nest, they tend to find other places to sleep. And yet they still have that instinct to build a nest, but they're just not sure why. And so they'll collect little piles of sticks, 10 or 11 sticks, and then just sit on them. It doesn't serve any purpose to them to do that. It's just something that they've learned. Oh yes, I should be building a nest, but they don't really know. Like they don't really know what they're doing. And
it's just a fascinating thing to do, to poke, to drive, to see the limitation of their cognitive abilities and try to understand why they do this.
Yes, yeah. Speaking of cognitive abilities and cognitive weaknesses, those sort of exploits, that's one of your two laws that you put forward in the book. Can you explain the two laws?
Yeah, two laws are just fun because biologists never call their rules as laws, but I try to make it fun. The two laws, first law is the law of cheating. Animals communicate with each other. But, the communication, the message sent could be true or false. So if one animal sends a false information to another animal, that is lying. That is lying. But deception is different. Deception is, well, every animal has its limitation in terms of cognitive ability. And some cognitive abilities are biased, others are basically you cannot feel. So, for example, our eyes are more sensitive to red color than, for example, other colors, blue or green. So if you have if something could pick up a red color, that would be more likely to attract our attention. So that is a bias. But also, we have lots of loopholes, which means we have deficits. For example, normally we cannot hear ultrasound. Most of men, 80% of men cannot smell, for example, the muscone. These are the musty smell. But the women, 80% of women could smell. So there is gender differences as well. So that kind of weaknesses is also part of our cognitive bias. But that could be used by other animals of the same species, or even other organisms of very different species, they could fool us. And they do the same in nature as well. So that's deception. Basically, taking advantage of the weakness or deficit of another animal's cognitive system, and that is deception. If I have any contribution to the Oxford University Dictionary, and this is, I make a difference between lying and deception.
Magicians definitely draw a distinction between lying and deception. As a general rule, magicians try and minimize how much they lie, and rather, if you can tell the truth, just tell the truth, and focus more on deception. But also, we talk a lot about bullshit.
Oh, yeah.
There's the famous paper on bullshit by Harry Frankfurt, in which he points out that bullshit is not caring about the truth, and bullshit and lies do care about the truth. And it's this idea of there's more to deception than just lying. So it's nice to know that applies to the animal kingdom as well. Can we talk about motion dazzle? Because
yes.
I've been fascinated by this topic for a very long time, and yet I don't quite understand it. Can you explain motion dazzle to me?
Motion dazzle was a word that was originally proposed for zebra stripes. There had been, for so many years, people tried to answer why zebras got stripes. Now, for us, it looked very much obvious. But the first idea explanation was zebras actually tried to create that kind of diffusive or confusing images in front of their main enemy, that is lions. But in us, I mean, this is from human perspective. When you see some kind of zebra stripes, you somehow find it kind of like it's dazzling.
Yeah.
So that's the word, motion dazzling. My wife used to have a blouse with a very fine stripes of zebra stripes. It was it was making me dizzy whenever I look at it in close range. So that forced her not to wear that anymore. So I do feel why people come up with that idea. Turn out to be there was Tim Carroll at one of the UK schools. I forgot, either Cambridge or Oxford, but they studied it for many years and then realized the story was not that simple. Turned out to be that they found these zebras also suffer a great deal from bites by flies, like tsetse flies. So they suffer a great deal. So they began to realize, well, the zebra's motion dazzle may not work mainly for lions, to confuse lions. So they began to look into that. Until a Japanese research group, about 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, they actually painted their cows. The cows with zebra stripes. And turned out to be, they counted the frequency of fly bites. Turned out to be, those painted versus without painted, they found that after the cows being painted with zebra stripes, and the biting rate was reduced by 50%. 50%, that's huge. So apparently, these flies, when they come on the ice, may have cognitive problem of judging the distance. So they land on the stripes in a very awkward way. They may slip or may not be able to land. So I think that was the reason, probably the main reason why zebras evolved these stripes. It's mainly against these blood-sucking flies.
Black and white stripes, from the fly's perspective, as they're flying towards it, those stripes are moving very fast from their perspective. And so it's going sort of black, white, black, white, black, white. And again, this is a human perspective, of course. But and so the idea is they can't quite figure out where to land because they can't tell what is black and what is white, and everything seems to be moving and quite uncertain. And so they fly away. I know, so it's an oversimplification.
Yeah, I think that's We still don't quite understand completely as to how these compound eyes are related, or cognition by the compound eyes are related to the kind of how they land on certain kind of surface. But that idea was used by, especially during World War I and World War II. And there's one UK battleship by the name of HMS Kildangan. And that battleship was painted with white and black stripe.
How would that work? Because it's not moving very fast. It's like I thought motion played a role in the, because of the motion dazzle. If it's just sitting there in the ocean, wouldn't that just make it more obvious?
I think that's, you're right. I think that was the wrong idea.
Okay, good.
Based on our wrong understanding about the zebra, the function of zebra stripes. So they even built a ship, actually not once. I saw several of these old ships.
Yeah.
They thought that could camouflage themselves by causing some kind of motion dazzle. I think the effect, even if there's any, will be limited.
A lot of optical illusions designed for humans involve stripes. Black and white stripes, and often with curves, slight curves, and they work because our eyes just can't fix on a particular point. And so as we go around, as our eyes sort of dart around, we can't quite figure out exactly where the line is positioned. And so it actually appears to be moving in front of us.
That's right.
And so the theory is that animals might be experienced kind of a variation of this.
I think probably you remember one of my picture is about the t-shirt. You see that a person is so weird looking, sort of like there is a hole through it. I think it probably affect our depth cognition, so that it delude us to to think that there is some kind of hole in the body.
So it's creating sort of illusions of depth, but also illusions of movement, and I guess also directional as well, a bit like the wagon wheel effect. When a propeller or a fan spins, it looks it's going one way, but it sort of seems to look like it's going the other way. And
I saw a video. They put a sort of like ibis with that kind of stripes. And the dogs are afraid of going through it. So apparently it's not just for humans as well. It's probably for other animals.
Let's talk about false alarms. This is essentially where animals give off alarms in order to danger alarms of various types in order to scare off animals for a variety of different reasons. How would something like this evolve? How would an animal learn or develop an instinct that, oh, if I make this particular sound, I can scare off the competition or scare off potential predators?
Yeah, I think that's relatively easy to figure out the scenario. If animals can regularly emit alarm signal, they can just use it in another context, such as, for example, the Formosa squirrel. So when they squeak out the sort of alarm signal after mating, so they found once you have alarm signals sent out and your neighboring the squirrels will take shelter, and that could actually, after mating, they could secure their female or prevent their female from mating with the neighboring males, for example. And that is a way they can secure their paternity. I think that's relatively easy for them to use one kind of signal in another situation. I mean, even you see the sphinx moth, when you poke it, they mimic the chickadee alarm call so as to prevent other songbirds to come. Otherwise, they would eat them, right? So this is even harder to think, but that is magical. That is magical. And probably to me, I feel like animals have higher abilities to learn from others than we have given credit to them.
Do the alarms lose their effectiveness over time? If is the sort of the boy who cried wolf type scenario where we'll begin to the animals will begin to sort of start to ignore distress calls if they're used incorrectly or at non-distressing moments.
When others learn that nothing happened following, of course they will realize, well, that's not you. Sort of like a Chicken Little. It's a neurotic chicken was always calling that the sky is falling, sky is falling. And then probably the first rounds of calls may attract others to be alarmed and nervous. And then if she keeps doing that, and others would not learn, would not take it more seriously. That's also the case in groundhogs. There are studies about the baby young groundhogs, which tended to be neurotic, the often emitting alarm calls when they should not. So these alarm calls are often ignored by adults. So yeah, if the person who cries wolf too much, you lose your credit. The people will tear you apart.
So it's much like the cuckoos. There's a balance that needs to be struck between how much deception is allowed and accepted within a species, and there's a point at which it becomes too much deception. Animals will start ignoring the alarm call, and then when there's real threats, they'll be eaten. But if they use it just a little bit, then they can be successful. So is that the same kind of idea?
Yeah, that's the same kind of idea. Also depending on how dangerous the situation is. And for example, the coral snake versus the harmless king snake. The coral snake, their ring patterns are very different. If we compare them, they are very different. The ring orders are different. But normally, the predators, mainly the birds of prey, would avoid them, because if they make a mistake, and that could be mortal. So rather safe than sorry. So that's the kind of principle they would do. But in Australia, for example, you have lots of these very toxic snakes, and the people would not even get close to snakes, right?
Yeah, that's
right.
But
in the United States, besides rattlesnakes, in most areas, there are very few other snakes which are toxic. So when you see that they are not rattling, you don't care about them.
Yeah, that is true. In Australia, if you see a snake, you keep away. Yeah, you don't go near it. It doesn't matter what type of snake it is. We just avoid them all.
That's right. 80% of Australian snakes are toxic, are poisonous. Oh yeah, 80%.
What is surprising, though, is how, because we have the knowledge that you just keep away from snakes, and because we have such excellent healthcare system, the number of people who die from being bitten by snakes and spiders as well in Australia is very low. I don't think anyone has died in Australia from a spider bite in 20 years. That is, as a species, we have learnt. We've learned how to detect those types of things.
Yeah.
Is that is what we're talking about there, particularly with the coral snakes, is that an example of Batesian mimicry?
Yeah, that's Batesian mimicry.
Batesian.
Yeah, it's okay. It's because both pronunciations are used anyway. Mm-hmm. It was based on, if you say Batesian mimicry was discovered by the great British naturalist Henry Bates. When he was in South America, he found that the kind of non-toxic butterflies look alike, like toxic, very toxic butterflies. So even he, as a world-leading butterfly biologist at that time, could not tell them apart easily. So he realized that he went back to England, and after reading Darwin's book on the origin of species, he realized that is natural selection in action. When you have an edible, non-toxic species mimicking a toxic species, and that is Batesian mimicry. So they got protected by fooling their potential predator.
Does that apply to things like, say, butterflies that have eyes on their backs, that, you know, or even as a caterpillar that looks a bit like its head looks a bit like a snake's head? Are they examples of the same type of thing, or does it need to be a closer resemblance?
It's very much the same. It's very much the same. The eye spots on butterfly, they open it suddenly, and that would scare their potential predators such as birds.
I'm glad you brought up the coral snakes, because my daughter, who is 6, has a book, and it's called How Animals Talk to Each Other. And it's a little flap book, and you know, you lift up the little flap, it asks a question and gives you the answer. And she didn't believe that the two snakes, that the predators wouldn't just learn the difference between the two snakes. She was like, no. Like, but don't they just, but can they see? Can they see? Because it's different pattern. Can't they? The patterns aren't the same. They're not the same. And I'm like, well, they're animals, so their brains work differently. So now I have scientific evidence to back me up.
The consequence is more mortal. The predators, their predators would be more likely to avoid them, because a small chance of making a mistake that would make them dead.
Yeah. I mean, we were just talking about, I'm not going to roll the dice when it comes to different types of snakes here in Australia.
Right, that's
so
right.
Exactly. Yeah, same principle. Yeah. We talked about the ships during World War II. Are there other ways in which humans have learnt deception from animals, in which we've looked at something that's happening in the animal kingdom and said, yes, we can use that?
I involved in the study of panda about 10, 20 years ago, when panda was still critically endangered. The way the Chinese, I was involved as well, the Chinese were doing was to raise panda by hand so that they can have more and with higher successful rate. So what they did was they tried to dress up like a panda so as to make the baby pandas look at them as their real mother, so they would not make a mistake when they grow up, right?
Yeah.
So I think that is a sort of way of learning.
Learning from it, yeah.
Yeah.
And did it work? They accepted these weird half-human, half-pandas as real pandas?
There's no sort of like a double blind study, but apparently it works. Most of these pandas raised by humans could actually breed, finding their own panda mates. And breed successfully. So I think that may be a piece of evidence that it works. But you need a sort of like a double blinded control and to experiment with that. But you know, with endangered species, you will not commit any mistake.
No, you're not going to say, why don't we just give it a try? So we talked a lot about, obviously, what we can learn from animals, and there's a lot of comparing with what we have in common with animals when it comes to deception. But it seems like there are ways in which humans deceive that are unique to us as a species, particularly you talked about when it comes to social behavior and morals and so on. What makes humans different when it comes to lying?
One thing I singled out was humans undergo can do so-called institutional lying. We have social, political, economic institutions, cultural institutions, and humans could use these institutions to cheat. That they cheat on institutions, or cheat by institution, or the cheating between institutions. And these are unique, that they will never happen in animals because they don't have these institutions. So that's the one way I look at in the human world. For example, a few years ago, during the Volkswagen, Volkswagen cheated on their carbon emission. They called it a defeat device. Basically, it's cheating off their real carbon emission by providing a kind of lower reading. So lots of these environmentally friendly, conscious people bought a Volkswagen. Turned out to be, it was discovered by some engineers at the University of Virginia. And they realized that was cheating. And in the end, this sort of like a smart cheating device was discovered, and they lost billions of dollars $1.4 billion in recalls, and they also lost $80 billion in stock value in Europe alone. So this is tremendously costly. I mean, if some people were not chasing for immediate performance, they would not do that. So often I would say, people ask me, what would be your advice for corporations? I say, well, be aware of chasing short-term performance by providing incentives for some individuals. You have to care about your long-term health of your business. Honesty is still the best policy.
You also mentioned that animals don't have morals. They act, you know, if they're going to stop a certain behavior, it's because there is a disadvantage in doing that behavior. Whereas humans, we will do something that might actually be advantageous to us, but we won't do it because we've been told or we believe that it's wrong, without any negative consequences. There aren't any examples of that or anything similar to that in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, in the animal kingdom. It is never like that. If there is anything similar, that would be in social insects. The ants and wasps and bees, that's likely. Mm. They are bound together by kinship. The blood is thicker than water. But in all other animals, if we look at our close relative of apes, close cousins of apes, they never do that. The reason being that there is no downside of being manipulative. Actually, if you read Frank DeWolf's book about chimpanzee politics, these chimpanzees who are skilled at politics often rise high in hierarchy. So actually, there's a reward for being sneaky, being manipulative for their own interest. So that's in animals. But in humans, that's different. Humans, if somebody is manipulative, soon this person will be known as manipulative, as sneaky, as cheating possible. Just in any area, if the time is long enough, not long enough. But the reason humans would refrain from cheating mainly is due to, one is moral teaching, that's one. But more importantly, probably is our law enforcement, encouraging honesty while discouraging, suppressing these manipulative, antisocial cheating. And this is actually, these two things are really the basis for our civilization. Now that when cheating is limited to a controlled level, especially antisocial cheating is limited to a certain level, then the cooperation will thrive. And the benefit, the good consequence of cooperation is unlimited. Sky is the limitation. So we not only cooperate within family, at the workplace, we cooperate with people who are totally strangers. We cooperate internationally. For example, nowadays, not only in a village, in the town, in the city, even in the nation. And that kind of large scale cooperation creates kind of value, the kind of marvels in our civilization. And that is the fundamental difference between humans and all other animals. No other animals have reached to that level just by a simple measure that we control antisocial cheating to make their cooperation thrive. Yeah. I wrote a piece in Time magazine and lots of people said, well, that was wonderful.
Well, the book is The Liars of Nature and the Nature of Liars. It is out now everywhere. Thank you so much for coming on Scammerpalooza.
Thank you very much.